Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Lisa Hawkins, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally, in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's guest is Dr. Margaret Sands-Orchowski. Peggy Sands-Orchowski is the credentialed congressional correspondent for the Hispanic Outlook on Higher Education magazine in Washington, D.C. She writes 3 to 4 feature stories a month, plus a monthly column, Uncensored, covering higher education and immigration issues. She was Bill Analyst Editor at CQ in D.C., a reporter for the AP in Peru, an Inter-American Press Fellow in Argentina, a press officer for the UN in Switzerland, and a staff reporter and feature writer for her hometown newspapers in Santa Barbara, California, among other journalism positions. In 2013, she received a grant from the Fund for Investigative Journalism to pursue an exploding issue in immigration and higher education. Her book, Immigration and the American Dream, Battling the Political Hype and Hysteria, was recommended by Governor Bill Richardson as a must-read for everyone in Congress and every D.C. think tank. She has given over 60 book presentations at foreign affairs and public policy organizations and bookstores, including Politics and Prose in Washington, D.C., and has appeared on television and public radio talk shows in 18 states. She was featured in C-SPAN's Washington Journal on September 29, 2010, and her op-eds on immigration have appeared in U.S. News and World Report Opinion, AOL.com, the Indianapolis Star, and the Atlantic Journal Constitution, among others. Peggy lived and worked for over 10 years abroad, speaks and works in 4 languages easily, and raised her 2 children in 3. She earned a PhD and an MA at the University of California at Santa Barbara, another MA at Occidental College as a Coro Fellow, and a BA in Journalism and Latin American Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. She was a director of the Los Angeles Olympic Games in 1983-84, organizing, recruiting, and managing 125 multilingual staff at the National Olympic Committee Department at the UCSB Village. She is just past chairperson of the National Press Club's Freelance Committee and a board member of JAWS, a national women's journalism organization. She is also an avid swimmer, tennis player, and chamber music violinist. Please join me in welcoming Margaret Sands-Orchowski.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here and see that there's such an institute for students of all majors, and I hope there's some journalism majors here, too. Let me talk just a minute about being a journalist in Washington, which there are many, thousands, actually. Covering the big deal is to cover the White House, but I think it's much more fun to cover Congress, because in the White House you're covering one person who doesn't appear very often, so you're constantly exposed to just the people who spin, of course, the everything in favor of the administration, of course. In Congress, you have over 500 senators and congressmen, plus all their staffs, plus all the committees, which are really important. And you have a lot more access to them. So for those of us who get congressional passes, they give us a chance to go anywhere in Congress. I can go anywhere, including into the lobby, where the congressmen and the senators meet during a vote or while they're assembling to go onto the floor. And usually the only people allowed in there are staff and journalists with congressional passes. And the great deal about that is I can request an interview, usually during a vote. If you've ever watched Congress, when they call a vote, it's usually 15 minutes, and the congressmen are assembling, and they kind of sort of give their vote when their names are called. The senators rarely do, but the and the congressmen vote with a card. So they spend most of the time talking to each other. So us journalists up in the press gallery, we're constantly watching who's talking to who, who's crossing the aisle. The Democrats all sit on the right, the Republicans on the left, or vice versa when you're facing the president or the podium. And so that dynamic's important. But we can go down to the lobby and request an interview. And we don't have to go through the entourage of press secretaries then. But when they come out to talk to us for an interview, they do not want to be lobbied. They don't want to suddenly meet somebody who's an advocate of some position. And they've come out to be interviewed. And all of a sudden, this person who says they're a journalist is advocating. So to get credentials, you have to, you're strongly vetted by the press galleries. There's three in each chamber, one for the daily press, one for the periodical press, and one for the broadcast press. And unlike the White House, which is dominated by broadcast journalists, in the House and Senate, they're not allowed to bring cameras or mics onto the into the gallery. So the congressional, the both the House and Senate galleries are dominated by the print press, yes. But again, we are not expected to be an advocate. So both our publication and the journalists themselves are vetted by, the galleries are run by peers, by journalists from those, from that media. And they refuse credentials to anyone who seems to be an advocate. So I'm speaking to you as a congressional journalist. I wrote this book as a congressional journalist who covers all sides. I have to be able to talk to everybody, to Republicans, to Democrats, and get all points of view. Journalists, to me, there's three things that make a journalist. Well, two qualities that make a journalist. One is a voracious curiosity, and you just have to want to know why. You know, you're the 4-year-old grown up and say, why, you know. And the other one, though, that is tempered by, I call it, a healthy skepticism. The joke is that if your mother says she loves you, you get a second and third opinion. That's the journalism joke. But everything should be questioned. And, of course, when you're covering the White House, everything is questioned because you know you're being spun. But same with the senators and Republicans. And you have to learn to ask questions respectfully. That makes a journalist. That makes the qualities of a journalist. To me, a journalist, in addition, there's three things that make a journalist. One is that they report. You're a reporter. You are a journalist. You journal. You report what other people say, what a news source says, not what you think. What you think does not come into it. You report what a news source says. You get background information. You get history. You could fill your article in with not only quotes from your news source, and you should have, I try in every article to have at least three good original quotes from my news sources now, as well as background information. None of that is my opinion. This is to differentiate, of course, between a blogger. And the second thing that a real journalist does is they're edited. There's always at least one other pair of eyes that look at what you do to make sure not only names are spelled right and titles are right, but that you're not spinning. So the journalists, those two things, and as a freelance journalist, I add a third thing, and that a journalist should be paid. And as the head of the freelance committee for the National Press Club, my motto is to get the free out of freelance. And there's people blogging, just saying their opinions, oh, Senator so-and-so said such and such, and I think blah, blah, blah. And that's not a news report. And then they do it for free. And then people like the Huffington Post publish them. And they're killing journalism. So I'm just asking you, as young people going into public affairs, if maybe some of you will think about going. And journalism's a great field, even if you don't stay in it for a while. There's a lot of skills in journalism that help you in other fields. Well, listening, asking questions, writing concisely, getting to the point, meeting deadlines, all of these things are really important for other fields. So journalism's a great field to go into, even if you don't stick in it, or as I did, go back after doing lots of other things, like getting way overeducated, lots of degrees. Well, so now let's talk about immigration, because immigration is a highly emotional subject, as you probably all know. And the spin is unbelievable. So with my book, my emphasis on my book, there's two things I wanted to cover with my book. One is because I cover Congress, this is where laws are made, right? The lawmakers. And immigration reform is about changing our immigration laws. And so there's two things when it comes to laws. One thing is that for a congressional journalist, again, we can't cover all the committees. There's dozens of committees in both the House and the Senate. And one thing I didn't realize before I came there is that each committee has staff, and they have a majority staff, and they have a minority staff. And so it's really important who's the majority and the minority, because the majority staff, the majority Democrats in the Senate, Republicans in the House, they get the big offices. They get to shape the agenda. Every hearing has four or five, they call them witnesses. They're really experts. I mean, it's like going to a fantastic seminar on every subject, because they have the best. For instance, when I was writing a chapter about unions and immigration, the House committee was having a hearing on unions and immigration, and there was a head of AFL-CIO and SEIU and the farm workers, and I could go up as a journalist and talk to them. And, you know, it's just the most incredible seminars that go on every day in the House and Senate. But there's usually four or five witnesses, and the majority staff get to choose, well, depending on how big a majority. If you have a close majority, the majority gets three out of five witnesses. If it's a big majority, they get four out of five. So, you know, so it depends on how many witnesses you get. When the majority and the minority change, it's a really big deal. And the staffs... Now, to be a staff person on a committee, that's what most congressional staffers want to do. You start off as staff of a congressman or a senator. And, you know, you're usually, yeah, you have a nice title like legislative assistant, but you're opening envelopes, answering constituent mail. Maybe eventually you get to move into, after 2 or 3 years, of being paid around $20,000, $25,000. The pay is really bad. It's almost like an internship, really. Then you get to move into maybe a policy area that you're interested in. You can help interview people, cover hearings. Eventually you start getting involved in the shaping of legislation. But the real goal for most staffers is to get on a committee and be a staff committee. And to do that, most people have a law background. And I often tell people who want to go into be congressional staffers, political science is good. A law background's even better. You don't have to pass the bar exam, but to have a law background, most of the titles, the big titles in congressional committees are counselor. You're a counsel, and the counsel means that you're a legal counsel. So it's very good to have a law background. And if you have a law background and a specialty, that's even better. And then, so those kind of jobs are really good jobs, and there's some committee staffers who've been there for years and years, and they write the legislation. They advise the congressmen don't write it, the staffers do. So it can be a really powerful position. So as a journalist, I not only get to know the congressmen who are on the various committees, and of course I can't cover all the committees, so it's really important which committee has jurisdiction over the beat you cover. So my two beats really are higher education and immigration. So higher education, it's in the education committee. Oh, by the way, this is kind of interesting. When the majority changes, they also sometimes change the name of the committee. So when the House is dominated by Democrats, the education is called Education and Labor Committee. When the Republicans dominate the House, it's called Education and the Workforce Committee. Just little subtle differences, but it gives you the idea of the point of view. So that it's really fun. The the Immigration Committee, which, by the way, is in the Judiciary Committee. It used to be in Labor, as you'll see from this history, but it's now in the Judiciary Committee. It used to be called, under the Democrats in the House, Immigration and Refugees, and it had this huge long title. I can't even remember it all. Now it's called Immigration and Enforcement Policy. It's when the Republicans have it. Again, and being aware, and a journalist has to be aware, and I say, you know, the public should be aware of how even the title, even the name of a committee changes, reflects the policy and reflects the focus of that committee. So again, ask questions. Be really curious. Look at what happened in the past and what's now happening now. It's fascinating, and I just find it a huge kick to cover Congress. And the longer you're there, the more you start to see these changes and differences now. So immigration, we have always managed immigrants. There are so many myths, and my book is called Battling the Political Hype and Hysteria, but I also have a whole chapter here about myths and vocabulary. Again, as a journalist, you watch the words, just like the change of committees, you watch who uses what words. And and there's a lot of myths about immigration that just aren't true when it comes to history. You know, we have this myth that we always had open borders, we were always friendly to families, that anybody could come in, and that, of course, we're a nation of immigrants. And usually when people say that, they stop. We're a nation of immigrants. Like, that says something, you know. And yeah, again, you ask, okay, well, what does that mean? What does that mean that we're a nation of immigrants? Of course we're a nation of immigrants, but what does that mean? Are we the only nation of immigrants? Are we so unique in the world that we're the only? Well, of course not. I mean, all of South America, most of Africa, the nation states were formed by immigrants, usually immigrants from Europe. They weren't formed by the native peoples. So we're certainly not the only nation of immigrants. Does being a nation of immigrants mean we shouldn't have immigration laws? That we're open borders to immigrants? No, of course not. There's no country in the world that has open borders. And we didn't either, not from the beginning. It's very interesting, I think, to look at the history of immigration laws and how they've evolved and how we've managed them. And I'll go through it really shortly, but I did give you a handout. And because there's a lot of information, and I don't think you'll see it anywhere else, and it's in my book too. But there's several periods that I see several different movements and focuses. But the main focus on immigration, and we're seeing it again, is that immigration's about work. People leave their country in order to better their lives, usually because of work. If you're discriminated against in your country and you're leaving because of discrimination, it also means your job opportunities were really less. So there's two basics about, or let's say three basics about immigration that I hope you'll remember, as well as see it now in some historical perspective. One is that immigration's about work. And the focus was always that way. And even when we first had national immigration law, it was out of the labor committee, out of labor. And there was some talk, in fact, Jeb Bush, in his book, suggested it goes back to either Labor or Commerce Committee. The second thing is that there is a paradox about migration and about immigration that really makes it so emotional. And I think if we're aware of this global paradox about immigration, it helps understand some of the heat behind it and let you get beyond that a little bit. But the paradox is this. That it is a human right, and it's codified in the United Nations Charter, that every human being has the right to leave their nation state, their native country, their homeland. It's a huge decision, and it's one that that is awesomely respectful, really, that somebody decides to leave their homeland, go to another country. Forever. I mean, the idea of immigration is that you're leaving pretty much forever. You're not being a tourist. You're leaving. You're going to stay there. You're going to work. It's going to affect your family, your descendants, your children probably are meeting a new culture. Your grandchildren will probably not speak your language, will not know your heritage culture. Those are the consequences of immigration, and you will be leaving most of your family behind. Those are the consequences of immigration. It's a huge, huge decision, and it's to be respected. And our country was built on people who had the guts to do that, and is still being built on that. But the paradox is that even though you have the human right to leave your country, you do not have the human right, nor even the civil right, to just go into any other country like the United States just because the jobs are better, just because you like it. Maybe you have an uncle or aunt here. You went to high school here. Maybe you went to college here as a foreign student. That does not give you the right to immigrate. The decision about who can immigrate, who can come in, who can stay, who can work, and who can become a citizen in every country in the world is the core right of the sovereign nation state. They're the ones who decide. So you have the right to leave. You don't have the right to go in. Any place where you're going to immigrate, you're going to have to apply for an immigration status. You just can't come in and stay. No country in the world accepts that, and most countries in the world, if you come in and stay, illegally, it's a felony. You know, we're very generous about illegal immigration. We don't really consider it that serious. It's only a misdemeanor if you cross the border illegally. It's only a civil offense if you overstay a visa. So we haven't taken it very seriously. And in 1986. With the amnesty law, and it was called amnesty. Here's one of these words that everyone gets all hyped about. But let me talk about amnesty for a minute. Amnesty is when Congress forgives a class of people. I'm not talking about social class. I'm talking about a legal class of some kind who have broken a law. For instance, the Confederate soldiers who fought against the United States. I mean, they were breaking a law. They could be traitors, but they were given amnesty at the end of the Civil War. There's never been, as far as I know, an unconditional amnesty. So when President Bush said, well, his idea to give legalization, a pathway to citizenship to people who are here illegally, it's not amnesty because there's a lot of conditions. It's a conditioned amnesty, a highly conditioned amnesty. Most amnesties are. So I don't know when amnesty became a pejorative word. I think we waste a lot of time with this rhetoric. Let's just call it an amnesty, and let's see what worked and what didn't work in 1986 and what could work now, because that's what we're talking about. We're asking Congress to forgive a group of people who broke a law. If you broke a law and you're convicted of it, you can't get amnesty. The only way you could be forgiven is to get a pardon, and that's individual. But amnesty can be with a class of people, and it's a good thing. So, yeah, let's talk about amnesty. Let's not try to make it something that it isn't. But before we had immigration law, even before we were a sovereign nation state, we still managed immigrants. It's never been, you could never just walk into a colonial state and say, here I am, give me a job. As you know, especially in the colonies up in the Northeast, they were very religious. They were based also on religious reasons. And you had to be part of that religious sect in order to immigrate there. If you weren't the right kind of Protestant, you couldn't settle in Boston. If you were Jewish or Catholic or Quaker, I mean, you were severely punished and forced to leave. There were very few states who were open to Jews. Rhode Island and Georgia, there's a street in Old Savannah named Levine, and I think it was a Jewish name from early days. I don't think there were any Jews in the group that formed the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence. There might have been. But there were a few Jews in the United States then, but not many. We were not open to everybody. And we weren't open to families. The 85% of colonials came in as indentured servants. And it was a good deal. When you think of like the Dickens period, remember in The Christmas Carol and Bob Cratchit goes home and his daughter has been indentured to a family, and she gets to come home for Christmas, you know. I mean, her life was pretty much going to be that of an indentured servant, and maybe the best she could hope for was she would marry somebody who might have a little trade. But she was pretty much stuck in her career as an indentured servant. If people in those days came to the New World, to America, as an indentured servant, they could earn freedom after five. They could pay off their bond in 5 to 7 years. And then many were given, many states and cities then gave these former indentured servants land. They were given free land so they could start. And that gave them citizenship. So a lot of new colonials came in as indentured servants, became citizens, and, you know, the history goes on. But they didn't bring in their families. They weren't allowed to bring in families. And same with the thousands and thousands of involuntary immigrants, the slaves that came in. They didn't care about their families. They sold them, you know. And even when we finally had a national immigration law, which was in the 1870s, back east were particularly, especially in Washington, because in some ways it's still a southern city. So they talk much more about the Civil War than they do about the Revolutionary War, which is kind of strange for me as a Westerner. But the Civil War is a really big deal, and it's a big deal in Congress and in law, because many, many things that were the prerogative of the states before the Civil War, and almost everything was, everything that was not spelled out in the Constitutional, and these people who are very strong constitutionalists, they still believe that. The federal government only has the right to do whatever is specifically stated in the Constitution. And otherwise, it belongs to the states. And there's so many things that aren't mentioned, like education and health and all that. That's why education in every state is a state prerogative. It's not to the point where we can't even talk about national education standards. We have to call them Common Core. You don't dare use the word national on many, many things. We don't have a national driver's license. That is a state thing. We don't have a national ID card. That's a state thing. This is very, very uniquely American, but states are still very powerful, and they talk a lot about it in Washington. So one of those things but after the Civil War, some things became national. And one of those things was immigration. Before the Civil War, immigration was pretty much a state matter. They allowed people in that they needed and pretty much let people know when they weren't wanted. Kind of ironic when you think about today's situation. Some states wanted immigrants more than others. But in the 1870s, it became a federal matter, mainly because they opened up Ellis Island as the main port of entry for the whole East Coast. And you didn't need a visa. They didn't have such things as visas. You didn't need a visa to get to Ellis Island. But you had to be work able. That was the main criteria. You couldn't be sick. You couldn't be crippled or disabled in any way. And again, they didn't care if it was family. There are many poignant stories. If you go to Ellis Island, there's many poignant stories of immigrants who were not allowed in. And sometimes they were children, a crippled child of a family. And it was a very agonizing situation for families to decide, should we go back with that child or should the child go back by himself? But they was not going to be let in. I met a woman in Idaho whose great-great-aunt had glaucoma. She was about 16, and they wouldn't let her in. And she decided not to go back to Odessa, where they were from, but she went to Constantinople, which is now Istanbul, and she spent the rest of her life in Turkey. This was not seen as anything pejorative. This is the way it was. And so we were not open to all immigrants, and we were not that family friendly. That is a lovely myth that we built up, you know, but it wasn't true. Okay, so quickly, first immigration laws in the 1870s, then first national comprehensive immigration law was 1920. The important thing to remember there is that we actually stated a quota, because between 1880 and 1920, that was our biggest wave of immigrants, huge, more than in the past 20 years, mainly from Catholic countries, Italy and Ireland, and lots of Jews from the Eastern Russian provinces and Eastern European, the Fiddler on the Roof Jews. A lot of them came in during that period. And so finally in 1920, much of the same discussion as now, too many immigrants, they're changing our culture. Kind of ironic, I have to give you the journalism cynicism right now. Kind of ironic right now that now we have a Supreme Court where there's six Catholics and three Jews and no Protestants. Just a lovely irony that's always kind of fun to take note of, you know. But in 1920, they had said we have enough Jews and Catholics. They passed a comprehensive immigration law that set a quota for anybody but Northern Europeans. Northern Europeans could come in without, and no, with no regard to numbers, but Catholics and Jews and certainly Africans and Latin Americans and all that. And by the way, the poem on the Statue of Liberty talking about bring in your huddled masses, that was written by, I always get her wrong, first name wrong, Eliza Lazarus, her last name was. Emma, why do I think, okay, thank you, it's an E and I get it. Emma Lazarus, she was rather wealthy New Yorker, Jewish, and dabbled in communism, and she was very concerned about the Eastern European Jews. Her poem referred to the Eastern European Jews, not Africans, Latinos. She wasn't interested in those groups. She was interested in bringing in the poverty-stricken Jewish people from the Eastern. These perceptions have changed. The poem means much more now, but originally that's what it meant. So again, it's interesting to have some historical perspective on this, you know. This all changed in 1965, and mainly because of Ted Kennedy. He was an incredible driver of immigration reform, very liberal. But think of what was happening historically. Two things. One was the Holocaust. We began to realize the horrors of the Holocaust in the late 40s, early 50s. And we were terrible about letting Jews in the 30s and 40s. There was the quota. South America was very open to Jews. The thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of Jews went to South America, Argentina, Peru, Ecuador. They actually modernized Ecuador. And you can meet them today, very successful, very much part of the, these are Ashkenazi Jews. Sephardic Jews always went to South America. They are, by definition, Latinos. They spoke a language called Ladino even. So South America's always had Jews, but these are Ashkenazi Jews who came. But we were very bad at letting them in, so we felt very guilty. And this is when the immigration law went from the Labor Committee to the Judiciary Committee. Suddenly immigration became about justice because we were unjust about not letting them in. It suddenly became about family unification because we split the Jewish families, no? So that was one driver. The other driver was the civil rights movement, where it was absolutely anathema to our culture to have a preference for one nationality, one religion over another. 1965 Immigration Reform Bill absolutely changed the face of America. Now, anybody from any religion, any country, any background could come in. But it wasn't open borders, and it wasn't unlimited in numbers. So what the only limit was and it still exists today, it's called the 7% rule. No country, because, again, Kennedy was very committed to diversity, so all countries are equal. No country could have more than 7% of all the green cards given out in 1 year. Well, there's many countries where there's many more applicants now, and so they were put on a waiting list. And today, these waiting lists are quite large. They're not quotas. They're subject to the 7% rule. And you can name the countries. You can think of them easily. India, China, Philippines, certainly Mexico, other countries of Central America have way more applicants than 7%. So they're put on a waiting list. That law also said, and I think we're the only country in the world that allows this, that once an immigrant has a green card and a citizenship, and a green card, by the way, is the only visa that leads to citizenship. I hope you know that. That is so basic. But you have to have a green card, usually for 5 years, before you can get apply for citizenship. But then they can apply for, then the family, the extended family members. It's always allowed close family members, minor children and spouses. And there are some problems with some countries that have multiple spouses. You know, do you let multiple spouses in? We also allow extended family members to come in. And that's an amazing thing, adult brothers and sisters, aunts and uncles. And there's some question now if that's still needed. The other thing that happened with the 1965 law, unintended consequences, one was the waiting list. The others was we still needed people to come in for work. That's what immigration's about. And that's why nation states want immigrants, is that fresh labor, the new ideas, that, you know, there's nothing better than a first generation immigrant worker. They're hardworking. They're grateful. They don't demand things. They sacrifice for their kids. They're fabulous workers. Problem is, not everybody can be a first generation immigrant, right? So I say that immigration laws, there's two roles for immigration law. One is to bring in the workers you need, and the second is to protect the workers you have. And these two roles are in real conflict, and a lot of the fight about immigration law is trying to resolve that conflict. And again, you can't do it with open borders. So after 1965, we started seeing the development for the first time of temporary visas. That temporary work visas, student visas, religious visas, business visas, the lover visas. I mean, there's temporary visas for there's dozens of them. They have one thing in common. They're non-immigration visas. They're temporary. And they have a date where you have to go back. The foreign student was never intended to be an immigration visa. It was always intended that we would help people here get the education they couldn't get in their countries, and then go home as kind of ambassadors. So the State Department still talks this way. They're ambassadors to the United States. They have these wonderful experiences. They go home. They develop their own countries, and they foster good relations with Americans. And that, you know, the rhetoric's changed now about foreign students, but that was always the purpose behind the temporary non-immigrant foreign student visa. The problem with the temporary visa is that it was never enforced. There was no way to enforce it. The joke among immigration officials is that there's nothing more permanent than a temporary visa. So we give out over a million green cards a year, and it's very hard to get them, and you have to stand in line and all that. Over 2 million people come in a year on temporary visas, and they're not enforced. We never had an agency to enforce them. So here again, words are important. The agency that was developed to enforce immigration right from the beginning was called the INS, Immigration and Naturalization Services. S is a definitive word. Their main duty, their main will, their main mission was to naturalize, that is to give citizenship to immigrants who were here on permanent visas. That's what they wanted to do. That's what they like to do. They were also supposed to enforce immigration law, but they really didn't have the personnel, the resources, the background to do it. So those laws were basically unenforced. All of this changed with 9/11. That is the next big step in immigration, because all of a sudden, immigration was seen no longer, and with the death of Kennedy, it's the death knell of immigration being seen as a civil right, as being seen as a way to bring people in to better their lives. All of a sudden, immigration is now seen as an issue of national security, and this has happened on the border. Southern border, not for Mexican workers particularly, which has reduced a lot, but because of the guns, because of trafficking of people, because of terrorists coming in, suddenly we've gone from immigration as work to immigration almost as a civil right, now to immigration as a national security issue. So the most significant thing for me that happened after 9/11 is that we developed for the first time, we've never had this before, a Department of Homeland Security. We never had anything like that. And they put all the immigration services in there, including, and they did away with the INS. There's no more INS. So there's the Border Patrol, there's the Coast Guard that does coastal control of borders, there's the border customs enforcement, or customs people who do the ports of entry. And And then now there's two new bureaus, two new departments. One is the USCIS. That's the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services. Again, S is the definitive word. They do what the INS did. They do naturalization. They have some wonderful integration programs, lots of programs to help people become citizens, learn the laws, all that. It's a great, if you want to work for immigration services, that's a really great department to work for, the USCIS. The other agency is something we never had before, but was deemed incredibly important, and that is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. E is the definitive word. It's known as ICE, and its mission is not Border Patrol. It's enforcement of immigration laws internally. Internal enforcement of immigration laws. That also means temporary visas. That means workplace enforcement. Because one thing the 1986 law did was in the amnesty law, for the first time, it made it illegal for employers of all kinds, including homeowners, to hire people who did not have a work permit. I mean, what's the point of saying it's illegal to be in the country when you can get a job? So for the first time, they made it illegal for workers to hire them. They didn't make it illegal for illegal immigrants to look for work. And the Arizona law tried to do that part. And the Supreme Court cut that part down. But it is illegal for an employer to hire illegal. That also was not enforced. And that's something that I, suppose Michael Chertoff, and now the Gang of Eight, and a lot of the new bills that are in Congress right now are talking about upgrading internal enforcement, particularly workplace enforcement, meaning sanctioning employers who hire illegal immigrants. They developed for the first time a digital employment verification system called E-Verify. It is a voluntary system that any employer who hires more than 15 people is if they sign on to this, they can check, you know, the person gives them the I-90, which is not verifiable. You don't know when someone gives you the I-90 if they're really that person, that the name's on there, or if it's a false I-90, if it's a false green card, if it's a false Social Security card. So this E-Verify system links into immigration databases, and within a minute they can tell if the person that they're interviewing has a legal permit to work. It's voluntary. Some states have decided, like Arizona, to make it, you know, states cannot do immigration law. Remember, in the 1870s, immigration law became federal. And everything about visas, when immigrants come into the country, they come into the country, not the state. So immigration, visas, and all that is a prerogative of the federal government. However, states have a lot of prerogatives, especially on what to do with their own tax money. And some of the laws they make may impact immigrants. That's not illegal. You can't, it's not illegal to have a law that also impacts immigrants. So one of the things states can do is decide the requirements for a business license. And so Arizona said anyone who wants a business license in Arizona is required to use E-Verify. And immigrants' rights people complained that this was going to impede on illegal immigrants getting a job. So it went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court upheld that. They said, yeah, that's a state right. Just as it's a state right to decide if they want to give state money, they want to give in-state tuition, that state money, to illegal immigrants who are in college in that state, they can do that. If they decide to do that, that's their money. They can decide to do it. The feds can't demand that they give in-state tuition. The states can do it if they want, and some states have. And some states, many more states, have decided not to. That's a state prerogative. They're not being anti-immigrant. They're looking at their state resources and deciding how to use them. So it's really fascinating how many times things come up between states and the feds. Now, I'm probably talking way too much, and I wanted to talk a little bit about the politics of immigration, because it's gotten very political, which means it's gotten Republican and Democrat. And to be critical of my colleagues, the press has been really really bad about covering immigration. And as with most issues, they want everything to be binary. It's like a sports match. It's so easy to cover a sports match because you have winners, you have losers. You know, and in crime, you have good guys and you have bad guys. And they prefer that with every issue. Immigration is way too nuanced to do that. But still, we have now the mantra that Republicans are anti-immigrant and Democrats are pro-immigrant, which is just absolute hype. And I kept trying in 2007. There were so many. The 2007 immigration reform bill was actually made. It was like the bailout bill. It never went to committees. It was made in the White House by Bush and Kennedy. Bush and Kennedy were on the same page. Bush wanted the legalization of illegal immigrants. He came into office saying, any immigrant who can get a job should get a visa. Any immigrant, you know, no matter how they came in, legally, illegal, take a job for cheaper than Americans would earn, any scab labor, he didn't care about that. Just any immigrant who can get a job should get a visa. I thought, he is so libertarian on immigration. But why is he and Kennedy together? Because Kennedy, I mean, Democrats are supposed to be on that other side. Remember the two conflicts? You want labor, but you also need to protect the labor you have. And Democrats are very involved with unions. But Kennedy also wanted very loose immigration laws and very little enforcement. Well, I finally figured out that this is not a left-right issue. You have to bring the left-right into a horseshoe. And here's my horseshoe. You bring it down into a horseshoe. It's split. The Democrats are on the left. The Republicans are on the right. And it's a vertical issue. And on the bottom, it's kind of graphic that it's open on the bottom, is a very libertarian point of view, which is growing in the United States. And on the right are the Bush, I call them corporate libertarians. You've heard that term, I'm sure. There's corporate libertarians. They really see immigration as the source of labor. They want as few regulations as possible to get labor. And you know, again, we're talking as cheap labor as possible. Americans tend to consider labor as a cost rather than an asset. Other countries look at labor more as an asset. But we have very weak unions right now. There's a real correlation between strong unions, strong immigration law, weak unions, weak immigration law, which is what we've had and growing more in the last 20 years. So corporate libertarians want very little regulations on labor. They tend to be for pathways to citizenship. And there are many Republicans who felt that way. To think that, oh, Republicans are anti-immigrant. Gee, when Bush and Flake and Lee and Hatch and, I mean, you could name the Republicans. There is many, if not more than Democrats, who are for that. Kennedy, on the other hand, is a civil libertarian. There's a lot of civil libertarians, and they love libertarianism, you know, no regulations on marijuana and traffic, speed limits, libertarians in general want as few laws as possible, and they agree with the Republican conservatives on a lot of those things, and one of those are in immigration, because they see immigration as a way to bring civil justice, that the poor people of the world can come to the United States and once they get in, they're good to go. That they're to be protected. Their children are to have education. They're to get hospital care. They're to have all the rights of citizenship. Some people even say they should vote. So that's a civil libertarian. And Bush and Kennedy and lots of Democrats are on that side of the boat. It's interesting who's on the top. On the top of this horseshoe, the more the closed end, is a group of David Brooks, has a great term, calls them economic nationalists. They're kind of American firsters. Americans should get the jobs first. We should produce in America. We shouldn't buy so much abroad. We shouldn't outsource jobs. America first. So on the right, there's a lot. Buchanan, what's his first name? He has a magazine called The American Conservative. And if you read it, you'll find you're going to agree with a lot of stuff he says. He's not a neocon. He's not a religious conservative, though he's very Catholic. But he's an American conservative. So they really want restrictions and more enforcement on immigration. The interesting side is who's on the Democratic side of up there on that upper part. And there you have the Blue Dogs, Democrats. People like, is it Bennett? No, you're Barrett. Who's your Utah? Who? Oh, yeah, Michener. Yeah, he's a Blue Dog. He wants more restriction on immigration because Blue Dog Democrats they're faithful Democrats, and they're fairly socially liberal, except for one issue. And ever since we won the Congress back, that's a great story, in 2006, since when the Democrats won, I'm a Democrat. So when the Democrats won the Congress back in 2006, it was because we went for the Blue Dog Democrats. There was a book came out called Whistling Past Dixie, and it was written before 2006. It was kind of Rahm Emanuel's philosophy that we could win the House back without the South, but we needed the Rocky Mountain Democrats, and they were, for the most part, Blue Dogs. They were socially liberal except for guns, and ever since 2006, Democrats have taken guns off the agenda, now much to our chagrin because it's a big issue, but Blue Dogs want their guns. And fiscally, they're extremely conservative, and they're very worried about the impact, especially of illegal immigrants on hospitals, on social services, on education, on the costs that local governments have to provide. And they find them onerous, and they want to restrict illegal immigration and have more enforcement. So that's up there. Also, Democratic environmentalists who are concerned about population growth. For some environmentalists, they feel that population growth is harmful to the country, and so they want immigration restricted because that's mainly where our population growth comes from. That's beginning to change, but those are the Democrats on that side. So it is not, I do not cover it as a Republican-Democratic issue. I'm finding Democrats and Republicans who are on both sides of this. And so then let me just go quickly about Hispanics. It's the same with Hispanics. I don't think there's ever been more hype about any group ever than there has been about Hispanics. Hispanics, I write for a Hispanic magazine. I lived in South America. I know Hispanics very well from Santa Barbara. Hispanics, and you guys must know this too, are extremely diverse, extremely diverse. As I already mentioned, there's a lot of Hispanics who are Jewish. There's a lot of Hispanics who are Baptist, like in Texas. And one of the research I'm doing here, more and more there are Mormon Hispanics. In fact, worldwide, probably the dominant, I don't know what you call them, ethnic group, but they're not an ethnic group, it's not a race. Hispanics dominate the Mormon church globally. And it is said that maybe in about 10 years, Hispanics will dominate the Mormon church in Utah. And they're not in the group of 12, but they are in the Council of 70. There's a lot of Latinos. And we now have, in 2010, there were 5 new Hispanics voted into Congress, 5. Every one of them were Republicans. There was not a single new Democratic Hispanic voted in 2010. You will not see this in any newspaper. And one of them, the one from Idaho, is a Mormon. So he's the first Mormon Hispanic conservative Republican in Congress. Raul Labrador, you're going to hear a lot of him. He's on the Immigration Subcommittee now. And, of course, now, if you want to do numbers, you have twice as many Hispanic Republican senators than you do Democratic ones. 2-1, but these are the kind of percentage games Democrats like to play, so Republicans could play it too. Menendez and Ted Cruz, Rubio and Ted Cruz, the Hispanic senator in Arizona lost to Jeff Flake. So, and of all the dominant Hispanic states, the ones that have over 10% of the electorate, Hispanic. There's only one that's solidly Democratic, and that's California. And a huge proportion of the Hispanic vote comes out of California. So if you look at the numbers on Hispanic voting, it's just amazing. The biggest hype, and I really think as political scientists and if you're journalists, the biggest hype that the press does and that, of course, Latino activists never correct, is that they mistake the demographic for the electorate. There is no doubt that there are more Hispanics in the United States now, 52 million, than ever before. But less than half of that, only 23 million, can vote right now, because many of them are under the age of 18, and many of them are immigrants, legal and illegal. Oh, dear, I have really talked too much. I'm not going to allow for any questions. So does anybody have a hot question they want to ask, and or any questions or any discussion you want to do? I mean, one thing that I've had some interesting discussion about is how serious are people about illegal immigration, stopping illegal immigration, and if you believe in deportation. So we can talk about that too. Yeah. Oh, you're a foreign student?
Yeah.
And you graduated. And did you do your practical, did you do your year, well, now it's 18 to 24 months of practical training. Did you get one of those optional practical training jobs? Because you can stay here almost 2 years if you get a job in your field. And the foreign student office will help you negotiate that. And then a lot of foreign students apply for a green card from, or apply for either an H-1B or a green card for that. The absolute biggest issue and Obama's focus on immigration reform, really, and it's so interesting because most people, they see immigration from their own experience. So Bush's experience with immigrants was basically Mexicans. So his issue was almost all about Mexicans. Obama's immigration issues are mainly, you know, his father, both his fathers, because the Indonesian father adopted him. He used the Indonesian father name when he went to Indonesia. Both of his fathers were foreign students. So he's very sympathetic to foreign students. And every time he talks about immigration reform, he talks about giving green cards to graduate foreign students in the STEM fields. I don't know if you're in the STEM field, but if you are, there's a very good chance that there is going to be a bill in the next, this year, that will give a green card to foreign students. They probably will attach a DREAM Act to it because that bill is mainly going to benefit Asians, not Latinos. Well, as I say, the DREAM Act, because the image is that the DREAM Act's all about Latinos. Of course, there are many, many students who are here illegally who are not Latinos, and already a large group of South Koreans are starting to apply for the DREAM Act. So it's not going to just be about Latinos. The problem with the DREAM Act, and I wrote a couple of op-eds of why it can't pass right now, is that it's all the Democrats had after a while. They couldn't get comprehensive. They didn't want the DREAM Act to stand alone. But in 2010, it was their last chance. They'd lost the House. They wanted to pass something for Latinos. So they tried to pass a standalone DREAM Act. But they put everything in the kitchen sink into it. They made the age from 16 to 35. There's nothing about being brought in by your parents. There's nothing about knowing English or that this is the only country you've ever known. The way the DREAM Act is marketed, highly sympathetic. It would pass if there was legislation that reflected the marketing. The problem with the bill is that it doesn't reflect what is said about it. It's too big. So I think there'll be a watered-down DREAM Act that may be attached to this foreign student bill and an increased investment bill. They'll have increased internal enforcement, and those are the two issues that I think may pass. So it'll be a kind of, sort of comprehensive, but it won't be a real comprehensive.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. Let's express appreciation to our speaker, Dr. Orchowski, today.